So we're in 1 Kings chapter 20, and 2 Chronicles, I said 1 Kings. We've got a few more verses in 1 Kings left from chapter 22 that will, Lord willing, come up in our study of Jehoshaphat and Ahaziah, the king of Israel, Ahab's son, a little bit later, but we're almost finished with all the verses in 1 Kings, but we are trying to match those up with what we're studying in 2 Chronicles as we see the those things together. So we will get to that hopefully in our in the future in our study. But right now we're in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. As we're looking at more of what the Lord tells us about Jehoshaphat and his reign as king over Judah. And so we got started in chapter 20 a little bit last week. Just to review, we'll go back and read these first few verses here. In verse 1 it says, "It came to pass after this also." Now this was after after that battle with at Ramoth and Gilead, when Jehoshaphat went up to help Ahab when he shouldn't have. And so then that was in chapter 18, and then chapter 19, the Lord rebuked him for that. And the rest of chapter 19 told about the good things that Jehoshaphat did in trying to turn all of the people, not just in the tribe of Judah and Benjamin that he reigned over, but also in those areas where he had that territory, those cities that had formerly been ruled over by the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom, going back to his father Asa's time when he had taken some of those. And Jehoshaphat had built up those cities, but then he was seeking to turn the hearts of those people back to God. We know that he sent teachers and Levites throughout all the areas to teach them the word of God. So he did more of that there in chapter 19 that it told about, but also he set up those judges and all the land and told them to judge righteously, that they were to judge for God, not man. And it also explained the rest of the organization of his kingdom. So he was taking all of those steps and all those measures to try to ensure that everybody that he had under his authority as king, that they would know the word of God, that they would follow that word. And so that was his chief concern in his kingdom, which reminds us of what it said about him back in chapter 17, that Jehoshaphat walked in the first ways of David. So David had that love for the Lord, that he prepared his heart to seek God. And so everything that he did was with that aim, that he was going to fulfill the will of God. And all of David's decisions as king had to do with that. And so Jehoshaphat is doing the same. As we saw in chapter 19, it says that he prepared his heart to seek God, unlike Rehoboam, Solomon's son. Jehoshaphat was one who did. And so all of everything that he's doing as king is with that aim to have God's word followed. As we get into chapter 20, is after all of that. It says that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and with them other beside the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. And we're also going to see the children of Edom join in with this. So this is a conglomeration of people that, as we noted last week, that unlike the rest of Israel's neighbors, what did Ammon, Moab, and Edom have in common with Israel? Well, there was that shared lineage. As we know, Ammon and Moab were descendants of Lot, that was Abraham's nephew. And then the Edomites, they were even closer relatives, as they were the descendants of Esau, who was Jacob's twin brother. And those three nations, unlike all the other neighbors there, and the Canaanites that were in the land, those those Amorite people, the Lord had commanded Israel or forbade them from taking land, the territory away from Moab, Ammon, and Edom. He had given that territory for an inheritance to Lot's descendants and Esau's. You remember when Esau was, when Jacob took the, well, first of all, Esau sold his birthright to Jacob. So that allowed a double portion to go to Jacob as opposed to Esau, as well as the rulership. So he would have primacy over his brother with the birthright. And, but then the blessing that Jacob had taken from Esau, and that included the best of the land, and that went to Jacob also. And so Esau sought a blessing. Did God give him a blessing, and did God give him a place of inheritance for his children? And the answer is yes. But what was it compared to what Jacob received, Israel? And this was by God's will. I mean, the land that flowed with milk and honey, that went to Jacob. Where did the Edomites dwell? And we read about it in a number of passages, especially when we get to the prophets, the major prophets, as we have chapters of prophecy against the Edomites for their wickedness, and Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, also the entire book of Obadiah, one of the minor prophets. So there's a lot of material in the prophets where God was rebuking and then going to punish Edom ultimately. And he did, and they were utterly destroyed. That comes up in the book of Malachi. Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. As he's speaking about the nations, God used as an example when they were saying that God didn't love them. He said, well, you want to see an example of somebody I don't love? Look at Edom, which at that point, when he wrote Malachi, Edom was out of existence. Israel was not. So that was the example that was used there in Malachi chapter 1. So there's a lot about what happened to Edom ultimately. But it was a wicked nation, just like Ammon and Moab were wicked nations. But God had preserved them. Edom, that land was south of Judah. In fact, south of Moab and Ammon. And it was a rocky place. And so they had dwelling places. They built houses in the rocks. So it was not a land that flowed with milk and honey. Nevertheless, the Lord would not allow Israel to take that for themselves. He also forbade those other nations from taking away what God had given to the children of Israel by his will. But they're not following that. So here they are all joined together. Did they have a hatred for their brother Israel? They did. And so this was a problem that persisted, and we see it coming up many times again in the future. Now, we've already had glimpses of it back in the time of the judges. In fact, when Israel first, even before they conquered Canaan and crossed the Jordan River onto the other side, when they came up through and Edom, Moab, Ammon, would they give Israel even any water for their journey? They would not, and they refused them any kind of help at all. Israel passed through, and then when they got through to the east side of Jordan, in that land over there, and Bashan and Gilead, in fact, Gilead being where Ramoth was, that the Syrians bordered, and then they had taken away Ramoth from Ahab. So all this comes back, and we see tied into so much of what we read throughout Israel's history. But when Moses led them through out of the wilderness and they entered on that east side of Jordan, they took that land from Sihon and Og, those two Amorite kings on the east of Jordan. Whose king saw that and then feared and then hired Balaam to try to curse Israel? That was the king of Moab. Balak, the king of Moab, did that. So right there from the beginning, we could see that hatred on display. And Moab wanted Israel cursed Well, Moab had nothing to fear because God forbade them, Israel, from taking his land anyway. But that didn't stop him from seeking to have Israel cursed. Who was it that Jephthah had to remind of the history when they were lying about it? Which nation was encroaching on Israel's territory to try to take it away in Jephthah's time, one of the judges? It was the children of Ammon, and they took that. And even before then, the fat king Eglon, when he had oppressed Israel, he was king of what? Moab. I mean, so there were, this keeps coming up over and over again. With Moab, Ammon, King Saul, I mean, which of the enemies did he initially fight off, which was at the time when they demanded a king? They wanted a king to lead them in battle. So Nahash was threatening them at that time, the king of Ammon. And so God gave them victory again over them. So this is a perpetual problem, but now here they all are coming together. Moab, Ammon, and Edom against Jehoshaphat. So he's got three kings coming against him as one, three of these nations. So in verse 2, it says in 2 Chronicles 20, it says, "Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, 'There cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea on this side Syria, and behold, they be in Hazaz or Tamar, which is in Gedi.' And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah." Well, there we see the right response of a righteous man when confronted with a problem like he was. So when he had these kings gathered against him, it says that he set himself to seek the Lord and then proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. He wanted all of his people to be fasting and asking God for deliverance from the situation. So did he have the right? He had a problem when he's got all these people coming against him. Did he find the right solution to his problem? He did, and it's the right solution to all of our problems. God's the only one that can solve our problems, isn't he? But we have to seek him and seek his help and do his will. If we're trying to do things on our own, and how many times have we seen that? How many times have we seen, we most recently saw that with Ahab. He had a big problem, and his problem was with God. That's why God had sent the Syrians to take away part of his territory. So Ahab tried to solve his problem his own way and force it back into his hand. And how did that go? I mean, he failed utterly, as any time that anybody is resisting God and fighting against God is going to fail. But if we're not seeking God to help us and to solve our problems for us, it's not going to be solved. Well, what about, these are three enemies at once. I mean, I think we mentioned at the very close of our time together last week, an example from early in Israel's history when they did cross the Jordan River and entered into Canaan. Well, the first city they took was Jericho, which was not a small one. It was not insignificant. It was not weak. It had those mighty walls that God made to fall down. They didn't have to do anything. Did they have to hurl stones against it? Did they have to set up war machines to try to break down the walls or anything like that? What did Israel have to do by their own strength or power to try to breach those mighty walls of Jericho? Nothing. They had to obey God and his instructions. So they had to believe what God said when God said he would make the walls fall if they met his conditions and did what he said, to march around the city once a day for 6 days and then seven times on the seventh day, and with the ark carried before them, the priest there, and then blowing the trumpets and giving the shout at the time that God said. And when they did all of that, what happened to the walls? Down they went. God made them fall. They didn't have to do anything physically to do that. God took care of it himself. And that was the first city that fell, Jericho. The next one was little Ai. And they didn't even send the whole army. Joshua sent a few there to take it. It was a small, rather insignificant town. And, well, we don't need to waste the whole army going against that little town. But what happened? Little as they were, now, they failed, of course, in that first battle. And then Joshua recognized there was a problem. And then he asked God what the problem was. So there was a situation when facing something that looked relatively small, we can do this, not really thinking about, okay, even with these little things, down to the smallest matters, should we try to handle those on our own and just save the big stuff for God? I mean, is that the way we should be thinking about things? Or should we see God in everything and whatever it is and ask the Lord for his direction, for his help and guidance in every decision we make, everything that we do? We need to have that in mind. That's what the lesson is. So Israel fell before that little Ai because they had the cursed things in the camp because of Achan. But, I mean, if Joshua had asked him before the battle, shall we go up against Ai? How shall we go? I mean, that would have clearly been revealed beforehand. So they obviously didn't ask in that case, and they found out the hard way. It was a harsh reminder, but we have the lesson for us. So even with the smallest of things, we need to be seeking God and seeking for his help and his blessings. And with God, I mean, what is possible? All things. I mean, could Jericho fall? Could the entire land of Canaan fall to the Israelites with God's help? Could the Philistines fall in battle because of the work of Jonathan, who just took his armor bearer with him and attacked the garrison of the Philistines, just the two of them? It did, because Jonathan understood God didn't need big numbers in order to help them or to give them a victory. Jonathan had his faith in the Lord, and this is in 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 6, when Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, "Come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." So did Jonathan understand it didn't matter as far as how many they had? I mean, all they needed was God. Isn't that the same faith that Joshua and Caleb had when they went into the land of Canaan to spy it out with the others? They had the promise of God that if they obeyed his commandments, their enemies would fall before them. Did Joshua or Caleb need any more than that? They needed nothing more than that. So they understood that their part was to seek God and do his will. And then that meant when God said he would make their enemies fall before them, it didn't matter how big the giants were that were there in the land. It didn't matter how many cities there were, how high their walls were, or any of that, how numerous, none of that mattered. They understood, and they said, well, let's go up, let's go now. God will deliver this into our hands. The others murmured, and because they didn't have the faith that Joshua and Caleb did. Worse than David in 1 Samuel chapter 17, when Goliath was confronting them. I mean, did David have a different promise than what God had given to the rest of Israel? Did David have a different promise than what Joshua and Caleb had when they'd gone into the land so many years before and believed what God had promised, that he would make their enemies fall before them if they kept his commandments? Did David have a different promise? Did Saul have a different promise? King Saul. They all had the same promise. There was the same promise for all the spies that went into Canaan. Two of them believed it. What about the other ten? They didn't. Well, David had the same promise. And Jonathan, Saul's son, they believed God's promise. What about Saul? He didn't. So when Goliath is confronting them with the Philistines' mass there, and for 40 days and 40 nights he's going out there blaspheming and defying God and his armies, what is Saul doing all that time? Nothing. He's cowering on that hilltop with the army, and they're all afraid. Why? I mean, they didn't believe God is the problem. They didn't believe his promise. So when David came into the camp and he heard when he heard that man, then he wanted to know, he was wanting to know who was this that was defying the armies of the living God. Well, his brothers rebuked him. But then David said in 1 Samuel 17:29, he says, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" He recognized a cause there. These were the enemies of Israel, and here they were doing nothing when God said to go and destroy their enemies and that he would be with them and do it. And that's why David went down there. Did David need that armor of Saul that he gave him to go and face that giant? No. I mean, the armor, that's not what was going to save him. That's not what was going to give him the victory. And so David understood that. He put that off of him. He went down there with his staff and the bag and put five stones in it. And we know what happened. But when David was going down there to face Goliath, he told him in 1 Samuel 17:45, he says, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied." He said that Goliath was going to be killed, and he says that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Joshua and Caleb believed that. Jonathan believed that. David believed that. Of course, we have all the judges that believed that. Well, Jehoshaphat believes that. Now, we read about all them. This was in the Old Testament when they were fighting their physical enemies. When we think about it, though, I mean, who's stronger, Goliath or Satan? Who's stronger, Jericho or Satan? Who's stronger, Moab, Ammon, and Edom together or Satan? I mean, who is our adversary? The devil. We know 1 Peter 5. And verse 8, he's our enemy. We're not fighting against flesh and blood. We're fighting against principalities and powers and against spiritual wickedness in high places. We're in a spiritual war, and we're facing the wiles of the devil himself. Well, is there any man or any kingdom of men that, I mean, when they were coming against Israel, I mean, who were they serving? I mean, who's the one behind all the evil? Who is our enemy ultimately? It's not man, it's the devil. And does the devil have any power? I mean, whatever the Lord allows him to have, but I mean, the devil has, I mean, he's going to and fro through the earth and walking up and down in it. Can any man do that? And be tempting and seeking to destroy. I mean, he's working to deceive all these nations. There's 7 billion people in this world, and the devil's got most of them. And he's working hard against all of us. I mean, there's a lot of power there, isn't there? What are we ourselves against him? I mean, Israel couldn't take on Ai without the Lord. I mean, how are we going to fare against Satan without the Lord? But we're reminded of 1 John chapter 4 and verses 5 and 6. When we are facing the devil with all of his wiles and all of his power, when we have God on our side, who is greater? Well, that's what 1 John 4, verse 4 says. You're of God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. Who is he that is in the world? Who is the prince of this world? That's the devil. Greater is he that is in us than the one that's in the world. Who's the one in us? Well, that's the Lord. And so he's really making a statement about God versus the devil in terms of power. And that's what the battle actually is. It's not us against the devil. If it is, we're going to fall. But if it's God against the devil, then who's going to lose? The devil's going to lose. The devil's going to lose every time. That's why when God says, here's my armor, here's what you do when you go and fight against him, I will fight for you in this battle against the devil, against these temptations, and here's what I'm giving you so that you can prevail in that fight. Why aren't we going to prevail in the fight if we do that? So we should see the parallel, the connection. This is why we have all of this here preserved for us that was written in the Old Testament. That's our study this morning too, isn't it? But we have these examples for our learning. These are things to encourage us in our fight, because it's the same God that was doing what he did for Israel when we see the ones who believed in him, when they did what he said, God fulfilled his promises and he gave them victory over mighty enemies over and over again. And how many times we read about that? The fight is the Lord's, it's not man's. Well, the same is true of us. This fight against the devil is not our own, it's not our personal fight. It's the Lord's battle for us. We're his child. And if he be for us, who can be against us? And with his strength, what can we do? We can do all things, but we can do nothing without him. But Joseph, he understood that, and he believed that the battle was God's. He believed this was a problem that God could solve and no one else could. And this was something that had happened also with Jehoshaphat's father, Asa, when he was confronted by a great enemy. This is back in chapter 14 of 2 Chronicles, in verse 9, when the Ethiopian, Zerah the Ethiopian, came against Asa with a host of 1,000,000. And for the math aficionados in the crowd, I mean, how much is 1,000,000? That's what we call a million. So I mean, here's a million strong army coming against Asa. Well, how is he going to do versus a million, an army of a million? Well, by himself, he wasn't going to prevail, but he had that 1,000,000 with 300 chariots, and so Asa went out against him. But in verse 11 of 2 Chronicles 14, Asa cried unto the Lord his God and said, Lord, it is nothing with thee to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on thee, and in thy name we go against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God, let not man prevail against thee. That was the faith of Jehoshaphat's father, Asa. Does he have the same faith? He does. And so that's what we're seeing here in 2 Chronicles 20. When he's confronted with this enemy, Jehoshaphat feared, set himself to seek the Lord, and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. Verse 4, back in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 4, and Judah gathered themselves together to ask help of the Lord. Even out of all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Lord. So was there any payoff now, or any, let's use the Bible word, was there any fruit, any good fruit born from Jehoshaphat's, all the efforts he had already made in sending people throughout his kingdom from day one when he became king to teach them the law of God, setting up these judges to make sure God's law was followed and practiced in the kingdom? So the teaching was there, the judges were there, everything to make sure that the people knew the Lord and knew his commandments and would follow them. Is that bearing any fruit now when he's proclaiming a fast throughout all Judah? Without that spiritual grounding of all the people, if they didn't have that, and the king himself was the only one following God, when he proclaimed a fast and told everybody, all right, don't eat, let's seek God and ask for help against this enemy, what would have happened? I mean, they wouldn't have believed. He would have been out there alone. They wouldn't have been fasting. They wouldn't have been seeking God. But what it says here is that all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Lord. Well, why would they respond to this call from their king? Well, he had already taken all the steps and the measures to teach them God, to teach them to follow the Lord and to seek him. So from that standpoint, was this really something new or different for him to now call on them in this time of trouble to seek God? Or was this really a continuation, an offshoot, an application of what he's already been teaching them to do since he's been king? This just goes along with all the rest of it and the teachings to seek the Lord. Well, that's we need to especially do that when confronted with a problem, with trouble like this. And so when he called them to do this, they came from all the cities of Judah to seek the Lord. So he wasn't alone in this. And they're not saying, King, you're crazy. We don't need to waste our time fasting and coming together and praying. We need to be getting an army together, make sure the army's trained so that they can be equipped and ready to fight this powerful enemy. They're not saying that. They don't think there's anything strange about this at all. Look around. How many nations would this be the approach, given a threat like this? I mean, it's only going to be with somebody who believes in God and trusts the Lord to respond in this way. This shouldn't be uncommon for Israel, but sadly it is. We have those examples that stand out, many of which we've already mentioned, but sadly it's too few that we see those kinds of examples. We see far too many cases where they have their troubles because they weren't obeying the Lord in the first place. But everybody, they had to be tested, so... this is a trial or a test of the faith of Jehoshaphat and his people that an enemy would come. Did God say, if you keep my commandments, no enemy is going to come against you? He didn't say that. He said, if you keep my commandments, when your enemy does come against you, they'll come one way and flee seven. But did he say they weren't going to come? Well, they had to have their test. They were going to come, but if they believed the Lord and followed him and kept his commandments, when they came, they would be turning around and going the other way, fleeing seven ways. That was the promise. So the fact that an enemy has come up to threaten them, I mean, that's to be expected. Just like we're going to have trials, we should expect there's going to be temptations. We're going to have our faith tried. The Lord's got to, he's got to find out what's in our hearts. He's got to put us through these things. He's got to help us to grow from them as we endure. But when we face them, we need to be like Jehoshaphat right here, like Asa was, and like those other ones that we saw. But for those who know God and know his commandments and are going to have a love for him, this should not be a strange thing at all. And this should be exactly what we're doing. We shouldn't be looking for all the ways that we can handle something. We need to ask God to help us. Now, God will provide means to do it, but God's going to give us the help. And sometimes, I mean, there'll be things that we have to do, action we have to take as following him. But, I mean, there are other times, there can be plenty of times like this one. Judah's not going to have to fight here. In fact, God's going to tell him, you just stand there and watch. And is God able to do that? I mean, can God make a problem go away where it just goes away? He makes it go away without us actually having to really do anything. And yes, he can. Sometimes he'll do that. We need to ask him to help us in whatever way he provides. And even if he makes it go away because we ask him for the help. However the Lord does it, he's going to get it done if we trust in him, and we'll get through it and be able to please God. Does that mean that nothing bad's ever going to happen to us? That's not what that means. In fact, we know that plenty of the Lord's people have even been killed for their faith, but Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. The key point is whatever trial we go through, that we overcome the temptation that's within it. The temptation to rebel against God by returning evil for evil, or for quitting and losing our faith. So not believing, not obeying in whatever way that is. The success and the victory in the battle is overcoming all of that. And even if we overcome all of that and then we lose our physical life, I mean, in the end, then what happens? Well, we've been victorious, and so then we'll have that eternal reward. So it's overcoming the temptation, pleasing God in all things, that is the goal. So they're asking the Lord for help. And so they came from all the cities to seek God. So the response to this crisis is, all right, everybody's going to come together. We're going to fast. We're going to pray. We're going to ask God to help us. That's the right approach. Verse 5, and Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Lord before the new court. So they're gathered here at the temple. I mean, that's when the temple was dedicated by Solomon. If we were to go back and reread from 1 Kings chapter 8 or 2 Chronicles chapter 6, and which are lengthy chapters, but we recall the words that Solomon spoke before that temple on the day it was dedicated to the Lord. And Solomon said when Israel faced enemies and they had troubles, that they would come to this place and gather there. And Solomon said when they do that, hear their prayers. That was his request, that would be something God would do by his authority, because God's authority would be, when it says that God would dwell there, and it was his name would dwell in that house. This was the seat of God's authority for Israel here at the temple. So when they're gathering there in that location under these circumstances, are they acknowledging that God has authority, he has the power to save them and deliver them? They're following through exactly what God told them to do, and what's the temple for? So they've come there to that place under this circumstance to do exactly what Solomon had mentioned from day one that they would do there. And so when he's there before all the people in verse 6, he said, O Lord God of our fathers, art not thou God in heaven, and rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen? And in thy hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee? Well, these are rhetorical questions. He's speaking these facts that he believes in, and that all the people together are believing in. They're acknowledging these things. They're acknowledging God's authority and his power, and these are truths. But look at the understanding of Jehoshaphat here. He says, O Lord God of our fathers. So did Jehoshaphat believe that God he was praying to was the God of this nation, that they were his people, that they were the ones going back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that God had promised to make a great nation and give them this land and gave them that law and the commandments and all those promises, including deliverance over their enemies? Did Jehoshaphat believe all of that? I mean, that's all captured in that acknowledgement, O Lord God of our fathers. And then he says, art not thou God in heaven? Now, does he believe that God's dwelling, his actual dwelling place, is inside that building where he's standing in front of, the temple? No, he knew better, just like Solomon did. But he knows God is a spirit and God dwells in heaven. But as such, being the God that dwells in heaven, who does that make him the ruler of? I mean, who is he? He's the creator of heaven and earth. He's the creator of all things and the ruler of all things. And that comes out in his next statement there. And says, and rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen? So did Jehoshaphat believe that God's authority was only over the nation of Israel? I mean, that was the nation that God had taken as his people, and that he made a covenant with, that made them unique of all the nations and people on earth. But was that the only nation that God ruled over? Was that the only nation that where God set up the rulers thereof? God is the ruler of the whole earth. I remember back when I was in college, and I took a lot of history classes. Got a minor in that, but I had an interest in that. Had to take a certain number of credits, and so I'd rather have taken it in that than some other things I had a choice in. But I do remember very distinctly to this day in one of those history classes, and the professor was talking about it. It came up with world history and talking about Israel for a bit, and one of the things, and I've seen reference to this in other places. This is kind of a standard view that many historians in academia have. They're wrong. But what they said was that Israel developed this concept that their idea of God evolved from being a personal God of the nation to eventually that they believed that their God was not just their own God, but was the God of all the earth. That is totally false. There was no evolution in Israel's view of God. There's no change in the view of God in the Bible. Where do we first read in the Bible that God was God not just over one nation, Israel, but that God was God over all the earth? What's the first verse in the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What does that mean? I mean, that the opening statement of the Bible is a statement that the God, the one who is giving this book, this is the creator of all things, the ruler of all things, the one and only God who is now revealing his will to his creation, which is all of us. I mean, that's all captured there in the first verse of the Bible and everything that comes after that. I mean, there is no Israel at that time. I mean, it's much later in Genesis. We're not introduced to Abram until very end of chapter 11. And then we really start reading about him in earnest in chapter 12 when God promises to make of him a great nation. And then Isaac and Jacob. But that doesn't really come to fruition or fulfillment until we get to Exodus and they leave the land of Egypt. And then they're ultimately brought into Canaan. God was God of the whole earth before there was a nation of Israel. So people that make those kind of statements, they're ignorant of God, they're ignorant of his word, and they don't believe it anyway. But it's foolishness. But look at this statement of Jehoshaphat. Is Jehoshaphat saying anything different than what Genesis 1:1 says? And what is implied in all of that, the statement of God being the creator of all things? If he created it all, then how much of it belongs to him? All of it. He made it all. It all belongs to him. And how much of it is under his dominion? How much of it is under his authority? All of it. I mean, that's from literally day one in Genesis. And it was still true in Jehoshaphat's time. Jehoshaphat is acknowledging that fact of who God is. And so God was not just, he didn't just create the nation of Israel. He created the whole earth and all mankind. And that meant God was the ruler of all mankind. So did God have control over these other nations? Israel is the one that he made a covenant with and gave his law to. But did God rule over all those other nations? And was God in control of them? And could God do with them as he desired? Yes, yes, and yes. And that's what he's asking God to do. God's going to do that. So God's going to take those three nations, turn them against each other, and they're going to kill each other. And Judah's not going to have to even fight, participate in the battle. God's going to do that. So Jehoshaphat knew that God had that power. He's acknowledging it. And as he's acknowledging, and how much of what we are directed to do out of our faith when we are praying to God, when we're seeking him, is to acknowledge the authority that God has and follow it. I mean, this is very key. We remember Christ in Matthew chapter 11 when those nations of Galilee or those cities of Galilee that didn't repent, and he upbraided them, Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. That's in verses 20 through 24. And then right after that in Matthew 11:25, at that time Jesus answered and said, "I thank thee." Now that's not the usual word for thanks, thanksgiving. When he says, "I thank thee," that word literally means, "I acknowledge you. I acknowledge you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent and hast revealed them unto babes. Even so, Father, for it seemed good in thy sight." So Jesus is acknowledging his Father's authority here, and his authority in deciding who to reveal himself to and who to hide himself from. These cities of Galilee were ones who would not glorify God as God. They had rejected him, and so God had not revealed himself to them. He was hiding himself from them. That was the cause of their unbelief. Now, if they would turn to the Lord and acknowledge him, then that would change. That was the problem they needed to fix. But until they did, they were going to be blind. But Jesus was acknowledging the authority of God, the God of heaven and earth, which is exactly what we're told to do. Hebrews chapter 13, we see the same basic word here in the same context, and what we are supposed to be doing as we seek the Lord. So he says in verse 14, "For here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." Well, here again, acknowledgement to his name, his authority. So are we supposed to be acknowledging the authority of God when we seek him? Is that central to our worship? When we're coming before the Creator, when we are worshiping him in spirit and in truth, is that going to involve us bringing this fruit of our lips, this acknowledgement of the authority that God has? What is Jehoshaphat doing here? Jehoshaphat is doing that. He's acknowledging his name. He's acknowledging you are the maker of all things. You're the ruler of all things. You're in control of all things. And as such, please now help us in this situation. That's central to this. And is God going to respond to that? He is. He's going to hear that. And he's going to give them the deliverance that they are seeking here. And that's when he says, "In thine hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee." And that's true. None, including all these nations together. Well, God had given Joshua victory over five kings that were against him back in Joshua 10. In Genesis 14, how many kings did Abraham go up against? Same. So it didn't matter how many were united against one of the Lord's servants. If God was able to deliver them, and none could withstand God. That's where the fight is. And so in verse 7, he says, "Art not thou our God, who didst drive out the inhabitants of this land before thy people Israel, and gavest it to the seed of Abraham, thy friend, forever? And they dwelt therein, and have built thee a sanctuary therein for thy name, saying, If, when evil cometh upon us, as the sword, judgment, or pestilence, or famine, we stand before this house, and in thy presence, for thy name is in this house, and cry unto thee in our affliction, then thou wilt hear and help." So he's directly referring to when that temple was dedicated by Solomon, what Solomon said at that time. Those were his words there. And he says again, "Your name, your authority is in this house." So he is invoking God's authority, and by that authority he's asking God to help. And said that this is what they were supposed to do. And so he's asking God to hear and to help them now. And specifically in verse 10, he says, "Now behold, the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir," that's Edom, "whom thou wouldest not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and destroyed them not. Behold, I say how they reward us to come to cast us out of thy possession, which thou hast given us to inherit. O our God, wilt not thou judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do. But our eyes are upon thee." And it says, "All Judah stood before the Lord with their little ones, their wives, and their children." So all Israel is united in this, and Jehoshaphat is their king and their leader, and he's asking God for this deliverance. And it's based in that fact. What right did Ammon, Moab, and Edom have to Israel's inheritance? None. Just like Israel had no right to theirs, and Israel had been forbidden to take theirs, well, it's not right for them to take Israel's. And so Jehoshaphat's asking God to not let them take that inheritance he had given to them, and God is able to do that. So then God's going to answer through his prophet here and promise that deliverance that they're asking for. Would not God be pleased with what they're doing here, with what Jehoshaphat and all the people are doing, that they're turning to him sincerely with all their hearts, seeking him, acknowledging his authority, and asking him out of their faith in him to fulfill his promises as they're seeking him? If you seek, you'll find, and they're going to find that deliverance, just like all of God's people have always received when they seek him with their all their hearts, just like we will if we will do the same. So this is an excellent example and pattern for us to follow. Is this something we should do? Our lives, is if it's written as a book, is there going to be a chapter here and there or part of a chapter that would be dedicated to, well, we face a problem and we seek God in that problem. Is this something that's going to come up here and there? Or is this something that's going to be, we need to be doing as a pattern every single day? I mean, how many times a day are we confronted with a situation where we have an opportunity, okay, we have a choice here to, here's what God says we should do, here's what we shouldn't do, whether it's by our words or by our actions, our thoughts even. I mean, how many times a day are we confronted with situations, with temptations? And how often should we be seeking God for his help and deliverance out of that temptation? So this is something that's not just daily, it's all day, every day. This is what we need to be doing. So it's not just, shouldn't be just a chapter in the of our lives. This is, should be the book of our lives, the story of our lives, that we are doing this, that we're living for God, and that we're seeking him at all times. So this is the pattern we need to look to follow in that way, because God is the same God that Jehoshaphat was praying to is the same God that we are. And he will be on our side also if we will seek him and acknowledge him and do his will. We'll close there for this morning and continue with chapter 20, Lord willing, next Lord's Day.